Chapter 11. Another 2 weeks went by in this way, and during that fortnight an event occurred that Ivan Ilyich and his wife had desired. Petrushchev formally proposed. It happened in the evening. The next day Praskovya Fedorovna came into her husband's room considering how best to inform him of it, but that very night there had been a fresh change for the worse in his condition. She found him still lying on the sofa but in a different position. He lay on his back, groaning and staring fixedly straight in front of him. She began to remind him of his medicines, but he turned his eyes towards her with such a look that she did not finish what she was saying, so great an animosity, to her in particular, did that look express. "For Christ's sake let me die in peace," he said. She would have gone away, but just then their daughter came, and then went up to say good morning. He looked at her, as he had done at his wife, and in reply to her inquiry about his health said dryly, that he would soon free them all of himself. They were both silent and after sitting with him for a while went away. "Is it our fault?" Lisa said to her mother. "It's as if we were to blame. I'm sorry for Papa, but why should we be tortured?" The doctor came at his usual time. Ivan Ilyich answered yes and no, never taking his angry eyes from him, and at last said, "You know you can do nothing for me, so leave me alone. We can ease your sufferings. You can even do that. Let me be." The doctor went into the drawing room, and told Praskovya Fedorovna that the case was very serious, and that the only resource left was opium, to allay her husband's sufferings, which must be terrible. It was true, as the doctor said, that Ivan Ilyich's physical sufferings were terrible, but worse than the physical sufferings were his mental sufferings, which were his chief torture. His mental sufferings were due to the fact that that night, as he looked at Gerasim's sleepy, good-natured face with its prominent cheekbones, the question suddenly occurred to him, "What if my whole life has been wrong?" It occurred to him that what had appeared perfectly impossible before, namely that he had not spent his life, as he should have done, might after all be true. It occurred to him that his scarcely perceptible attempts to struggle against what was considered good by the most highly placed people, those scarcely noticeable impulses, which he had immediately suppressed, might have been the real thing, and all the rest false. And his professional duties and the whole arrangement of his life and of his family, and all his social and official interests, might all have been false. He tried to defend all those things to himself, and suddenly felt the weakness of what he was defending. There was nothing to defend. "But if that is so," he said to himself, "and I am leaving this life with the consciousness that I have lost all that was given me and it is impossible to rectify it, what then?" He lay on his back, and began to pass his life in review in quite a new way. In the morning, when he saw first his footman, then his wife, then his daughter, and then the doctor, their every word and movement confirmed to him the awful truth that had been revealed to him during the night. In them he saw himself, all that for which he had lived, and saw clearly that it was not real at all, but a terrible and huge deception, which had hidden both life and death. This consciousness intensified his physical suffering tenfold. He groaned and tossed about, and pulled at his clothing, which choked and stifled him. And he hated them on that account. He was given a large dose of opium and became unconscious, but at noon his sufferings began again. He drove everybody away and tossed from side to side. His wife came to him and said, "Jean, my dear, do this for me. It can't do any harm and often helps. Healthy people often do it." He opened his eyes wide. "What? Take communion? Why? It's unnecessary." However, she began to cry. "Yes, do, my dear. I'll send for our priest. He's such a nice man." "All right. Very well," he muttered. When the priest came and heard his confession, Ivan Ilyich was softened, and seemed to feel a relief from his doubts and consequently from his sufferings, and for a moment there came a ray of hope. He again began to think of the vermiform appendix and the possibility of correcting it. He received the sacrament with tears in his eyes. When they laid him down again afterwards he felt a moment's ease, and the hope that he might live awoke in him again. He began to think of the operation that had been suggested to him. "To live. I want to live. he said to himself. His wife came in to congratulate him after his communion, and when uttering the usual conventional words she added, "You feel better, don't you?" Without looking at her he said yes. Her dress, her figure, the expression of her face, the tone of her voice, all revealed the same thing. This is wrong, it is not as it should be. All you have lived for and still live for is falsehood and deception, hiding life and death from you. And as soon as he admitted that thought, his hatred and his agonizing physical suffering again sprang up, and with its suffering a consciousness of the unavoidable, approaching end. And to this was added a new sensation, of grinding shooting pain and a feeling of suffocation. The expression of his face, when he uttered that yes was dreadful. Having uttered it, he looked her straight in the eyes, turned on his face with a rapidity extraordinary in his weak state and shouted, "Go away! Go away and leave me alone!" 12. From that moment the screaming began that continued for 3 days, and was so terrible, that one could not hear it through two closed doors without horror. At the moment he answered, his wife realized that he was lost, that there was no return, that the end had come, the very end, and his doubts were still unsolved and remained doubts. "Oh! Oh! Oh!" he cried in various intonations. He had begun by screaming, "I won't," and continued screaming on the letter O. For 3 whole days, during which time did not exist for him, he struggled in that black sack, into which he was being thrust by an invisible, resistless force. He struggled as a man condemned to death struggles in the hands of the executioner, knowing that he cannot save himself. And every moment he felt that despite all his efforts he was drawing nearer and nearer to what terrified him. He felt that his agony was due to his being thrust into that black hole and still more to his not being able to get right into it. He was hindered from getting into it by his conviction that his life had been a good one. That very justification of his life held him fast and prevented his moving forward, and it caused him most torment of all. Suddenly some force struck him in the chest and side, making it still harder to breathe, and he fell through the hole and there at the bottom was a light. What had happened to him was like the sensation one sometimes experiences in a railway carriage, when one thinks one is going backwards, while one is really going forwards and suddenly becomes aware of the real direction. "Yes, it was not the right thing," he said to himself, "but that's no matter. It can be done." "But what is the right thing?" he asked himself, and suddenly grew quiet. This occurred at the end of the 3rd day, 2 hours before his death. Just then a schoolboy son had crept softly in and gone up to the bedside. The dying man was still screaming desperately and waving his arms. His hand fell on the boy's head, and the boy caught it, pressed it to his lips, and began to cry. At that very moment Ivan Ilyich fell through and caught sight of the light, and it was revealed to him that though his life had not been what it should have been, this could still be rectified. He asked himself, "What is the right thing?" and grew still, listening. Then he felt that someone was kissing his hand. He opened his eyes, looked at his son, and felt sorry for him. His wife came up to him and he glanced at her. She was gazing at him open-mouthed, with under-eye tears on her nose and cheek and a despairing look on her face. He felt sorry for her too. "Yes, I am making them wretched," he thought. "They are sorry, but it will be better for them when I die." He wished to say this, but had not the strength to utter it. Besides, why speak? "I must act," he thought. With a look at his wife he indicated his son and said, "Take him away, sorry for him, sorry for you too," he tried to add, "forgive me," but said "forgo" and waved his hand, knowing that he whose understanding mattered would understand. And suddenly it grew clear to him that what had been oppressing him, and would not leave his, was all dropping away at once from 2 sides, from 10 sides, and from all sides. He was sorry for them, he must act so as not to hurt them, release them and free himself from these sufferings. How good and how simple! He thought. And the pain? He asked himself. What has become of it? Where are you, pain? He turned his attention to it. Yes, here it is. Well, what of it? Let the pain be. And death, where is it? He sought his former accustomed fear of death and did not find it. Where is it? What death? There was no fear, because there was no death. In place of death there was light. So that's what it is. He suddenly exclaimed aloud. What joy! To him all this happened in a single instant, and the meaning of that instant did not change. For those present his agony continued for another 2 hours. Something rattled in his throat, his emaciated body twitched, then the gasping and rattle became less and less frequent. It is finished, said someone near him. He heard these words and repeated them in his soul. Death is finished, he said to himself. It is no more. He drew in a breath, stopped in the midst of a sigh, stretched out, and died. The end. Edited and licensed for text-to-speech by FreeClassicAudiobooks.com.